I forgot to ask, has anybody actually been listening to the audio? Is it, it worked well in the smaller room. How's it doing in this room? Because sometimes it seems to me like it gets loud and it gets quiet, and if it's bad that way, there's actually some post-processing I could do on it. I mean, right now I'm taking it off of this thing and I'm not doing anything to it, and I'm putting it online because that's the fastest way to get it there. But if there are loudness issues, yeah, I do have this audio studio at home, and I might as well use it for something. All right, so if there are problems with the audio, tell me. All right. You know, I said yesterday that let me reconcile some terms, okay, just to catch up on a couple of things from yesterday. In the handouts that you can get to from the syllabus, there's the so-called more extended state transition diagram. This is crap. This is the diagram that's customarily presented in operating systems. It is absolutely not the case that the process model in a real operating system works this way. And the reason it's not the case is what I said yesterday, that even if I swap a process out, some fragment of the process has to remain in memory on the run queue. So the swapping is actually an attribute of the process's state, but it's not an attribute of the process itself. So conflating that with the run state diagram is actually, I think, a mistake. Although this is certainly the classic presentation. As with so many things in this subfield, tradition is no excuse for incorrectness. I also said processes go on queues, but does anybody here not know what a queue is? Now's a good time to speak up if you don't know what a queue is. Okay. I should maybe say that in operating systems, there are two kinds of ways that queues get used. So one case is I stick something into the queue. Eventually, I take something off of the queue. And there are two ways I can take something off of the queue. I can take off one thing, or I can take off everything. And almost all the queues in an operating system, in some sense, a free list is really a queue, right? It's a list of reusable objects, and you take things off of it one at a time. That's not the kind of queue that we're talking about. In an operating system, when you hear people talk about queues, they're almost always, that's almost always shorthand for the term stall queue or wait queue. And so that means we're almost always talking about a queue of processes. Now, depending on the event type, you'll see queues handled in two different ways. So one way is, I need the next thing. And that'll be the case, for example, in the scheduling queue. I only can run one process at a time. There's no point taking off more than one. But the other way you'll see queues handled is sort of not in keeping with the traditional notion of queues, which is to wake everybody on the queue. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, it turns out it's not uncommon for multiple processes to turn out to need the same thing at about the same time. For example, I have multiple copies of the shell running, and it will turn out I take some code page out of memory, and it turns out they all need that code page, and so what you get is a thundering herd of shells ganging up to get this code page back into memory. And whoever gets there first will start an I.O. operation. Now, we don't want to do 4 billion I.O. operations, one per shell. So the way I described the I.O. happening yesterday, which I did in shorthand, is slightly abridged. What really happens is before you start the disk I.O., there's a list of all of the currently in progress I.O.s, and you consult the list because the one you want might already be on its way. And if it's already on its way, you don't want to start it again. You just want to wait for the one that's already in progress to happen. And if it is already on its way, then there's already an I.O. structure. And if there's already an I.O. structure, there's already a queue. All you've got to do is go to sleep on the queue. And when the I/O completes, the disk driver will wake up everybody on that queue. So there is this unusual attribute of the use of queues. More precisely, it's an unusual attribute of the wake-up mechanism. All right. I also want to reconcile a term discrepancy. So in the handouts, you'll see the term process control block. Technically, the process control block is the data structure, or data structures plural sometimes. I mean, it may be convenient to split up the data structure, that holds the state of a process. So the process is the name of an abstraction. The process control block is the name of a data structure. Having said that, you'll never hear me use the word process control block again. Partly, I'm not personally very much into obfuscating abstraction, but partly it's just too cumbersome to say. And in the context of talking about how operating systems are built, you almost never consensually talk about a process without talking about how you actually deal with the data structure. So this is a distinction that is useful at the level of teaching people how to program systems, but not very useful at the level of teaching people how those systems are actually implemented internally. Does anybody not know what a context switch is? Okay, good. That's why I'm asking. Right. So, one thing that's... Oh, you know what? I have, before I do context switch, I have a dangling item on address spaces. Okay, I've said in address spaces that you have on a 32-bit machine a 4 GB address space, and the top of it's reserved for use by the kernel. Reserved for use by the kernel simply means that if you look at the permission bits in the page tables, you'll discover the supervisor bit is turned on. And the reason that's useful is that the processor has two modes, user and supervisor. Okay, and broadly speaking, applications run in user mode and supervisor runs in kernel mode. Sorry, kernel runs in supervisor mode. And so the use of the supervisor bit is to make sure that the applications can't alter or read the kernel data structures. Which sort of makes sense. Part of the job of the kernel is to keep one application out of the shorts of the next application. So you need some enforcement and protection, and you can either get that from the hardware, or you can get that by doing some kind of an interpreter that implements a safe subsystem in the safe here in quotation marks in the style of Java. None of these things are perfect. However, remember I said that there are cases where, hey, everybody's going to use the same stuff. It's not modifiable. We might as well actually use identically the same stuff. Like, two copies of the shell can run out of the same copies of the code pages. Well, there's a second variation of that state. Suppose you and I intend to really share the state. And we really mean it, that my modification should be visible to you. And we're gonna intentionally make mappings in our address space that have that property. And that's okay. Things only get tricky. So the everybody is sharing with the same permissions case is easy. The sharing only becomes tricky when people have different permissions. And copy-on-write, for this purpose, is not that case. So copy-on-write here is an implementation trick where we're deferring the copy. But logically, the clients have the same permissions. My write should not be visible to you. That's why we're doing the copy. That's a logically private mapping. Copy-on-write is merely a technique for delaying implementation of privacy. So here's a second address space, right? Same rules. And it doesn't really matter what application we're running, because for what I'm about to say, this is actually true for all applications. When I say the upper portion of the address space is reserved for the kernel, I mean the kernel singular. So in fact, this entire upper region is shared. When your process enters the kernel, from the kernel point of view, the kernel data structures, they're the same data structures that are visible when my process enters the kernel. The kernel's mappings are shared identically across all processes. Qualifier. That ceases to be true when we start looking at multiprocessors. But until then, what I say is true. And actually, even then, there are a few things that are not shared, but generally speaking, those are exceptional situations. So a more accurate version of this picture would be to say that in some sense, there's a common structure from 3 gig and up, in which there's a common view, and then the application views are separate. Okay, why does this matter? So we're talking about an application somehow entering the kernel, either by a system call, or because an interrupt happens, or because a timeout happens, which is implemented by an interrupt. So I have some thread of control running in an application, and there's a hardware event that causes that thread of control to transition into the kernel. Right, and I've described the mechanism. The hardware actually has, in a dedicated hardware register that is not something your application can change, it has the location where that transfer is going to go. That location is initialized by the kernel early in the system initialization. Among the things the kernel sets up, it tells the hardware, hey, when we come out of user land or we take an interrupt, here's where we should go. In fact, it has to do that very early because it better do that before the first interrupt happens. So in fact, when the kernel runs its first instruction, interrupts are disabled. And the early critical phases of the kernel are to get just enough stuff initialized that you can turn those interrupts back on. Because the longer you leave them in this disabled state, the more clocks you're going to miss. And if you leave them disabled long enough, you'll actually, it's like the sweep hand on your wall clock is not moving. So, from a state transition perspective, there's a transition from user to supervisor state. Now here's another view of the same picture. That thread of control, which was executing somewhere in user land, part of the address space, does, in effect, a jump to someplace in the kernel part of the address space. So there's a jump coupled with the supervisor bit getting turned on. That's what needs to enter the kernel. And also, probably, there's a stack pointer setting.
Is this similar to, I heard something about ring 0 and ring 3. Is this also that?
Okay, so on the Pentium, okay, I've avoided discussion of rings because this is a Pentium-specific abomination. Other than that, it's a good idea. And I can and do have long fights with the Multics fans about whether rings were a good idea. And they're wrong, but it's perfectly reasonable to argue about it. Not that I have an opinion. I can just picture Virgil Gligor calling me in about 10 minutes saying, why are you saying this? You're wrong. Not that he has an opinion either. Okay, so the Pentium has 4 rings. 0 is the most privileged, 3 is the least privileged. So if you're familiar with the Pentium lexicon, when I talk about user mode, in the Pentium, this is ring 3, and supervisor is ring 0. Now, aside from places where one is forced to use ring 1 or 2 in order to work around some other misfortune of the Pentium design, modern operating systems don't use ring 1 or 2. the ring idea has failed the test of implementation. Bottom line is more rings actually isn't necessary, and in some respects it makes the issues more complicated. Okay. In the Eros kernel, which is one of the few kernels that actually does use ring one, ring one is used to run the idle thread. And the reason ring one is used to run the idle thread is because of an unrelated complication of the hardware that the stack frame that gets saved if an interrupt hits you in ring zero is different from the stack frame that gets saved if an interrupt hits you in ring three. Regularizing it's a pain in the ass. And the easiest way to regularize it is to run the idle thread in ring one. So it's an artifact of implementation. It's definitely not a desirable property of the kernel. All right, so what's going to happen now, let me scan that diagram, is so I have some application running and it makes a transition into the kernel and it runs for a while. Now, there are two possibilities at this point. Either it entered the kernel, whatever it did is done successfully, and we're going to go back to this application, or we're not. Why not? It blocked. Its quanta has expired. We don't feel like it. It's dead. Well, we felt like doing something else today for some reason. So here's a very strange consequence of this. That so case one is now we're going to go back to user land. This is not considered a context switch, and I'm leading up to an explanation of why context switch is a horrible piece of lexicography because it doesn't mean anything. The other possibility, however, is that our process will enter the kernel, it'll run in the kernel for a while, and it will choose to sleep. That is, to wait for some event. At this point, what we have is an idle processor. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take some other process that's ready to run, and pick it up and run it for a while. And then eventually it will re-enter the kernel, and in due course it will sleep. It may go in and out a few times before that happens, although usually if you come in, you're going to sleep. Broadly speaking, there are two reasons you come into the kernel, right? An interrupt, or you're waiting for something. Interrupts, in turn, have two subcategories. Timer interrupts, the only reason you get one of those is it's time for you to stop running in a well-designed kernel. And other interrupts. The net effect of the other interrupts in a well-designed kernel is the kernel makes a note to itself that it should get around to paying attention to that device sometime soon. And then it resumes processing of whatever it was doing. So in that case, you actually will go immediately back to the application. Ignoring high-speed Ethernet cards, that's a low-frequency case. It does happen. So B will eventually go back to sleep. I'll get to it here. And in due course, whatever event A was waiting for will complete. And at that point, what's going to happen is we're going to resume A. Okay, so if you look at the kernel code, from the perspective of A, it's as though the sleep call didn't return for a very long time. And while it was not returning, the kernel behind our back did something else. But if you look at the processor point of view, we actually changed what we were doing. Okay.
Why would a program leak kernel space?
Why would it leave kernel space?
Yeah, I thought it only has more power when it's in kernel space.
Well, it's not up to the program, it's up to the kernel.
So the kernel will take an arbitrary program and move it into kernel space?
No. There was a transition here. It was done by a trap or an interrupt.
Yes.
Right? That was a call instruction.
So
in effect, that was a jump instruction. When you made that transition, you started running kernel code.
Oh, so you're saying it's not the actual program that's going to kernel, it's just calling some kernel function?
It's the sequence of execution that goes into the program, into the kernel. But the program does not control what instructions are executed in the kernel.
Okay, I thought the program was making a call to some function in the kernel, and the kernel was actually moving the program's memory pages into kernel space.
No. The program makes a call to some function in the kernel, and that function runs, period, end of statement.
Okay.
Well, modulo, it might be a call that involves transferring some data from the program somewhere. So if it's a write call, the program may supply a buffer, and the kernel, somewhere in that process, may reach up to the application and say, good, now I need to get the bytes out of this buffer. But barring security vulnerabilities, the program does not tell the kernel what to do. Or more precisely, the program does not control what code the kernel will execute. It tells it what to do in the sense that it invoked one interface versus a different interface, so there's a particular operation that it requests, but the implementation of that operation is not, one hopes, under the control of the program. If it is, you might as well not have a kernel.
Exactly.
Right? You've lost... Now the kernel is basically a library at best, if the program can control what it does. Okay. Yeah?
Does PCB apply to the kernel?
I'm sorry?
Process
control block is a data structure, and it's a data structure maintained... Classically, it's a data structure maintained in the kernel. There are some recent generation microkernels in which that's not purely true.
Okay.
But it's the kernel data structure corresponding to what you think of as a process.
So it doesn't matter if it runs by kernel or in user space. It doesn't matter.
Data structures don't run.
No, used by. When something wrong with the process.
Okay, when I say it's a kernel data structure, I mean it's not accessible from user mode.
But the concept's still there.
The concept's there. But the only way as an application that I can have any influence, again, ignoring some recent microkernels, the only way as an application that I can have any influence on my PCB state is by making a kernel call where the effect of the kernel call is to have that action on my PCB state done. Okay, so it's kind of, in a very, very loose kind of analogy, it's like a C++ class where all of the state is private, and the only way I can manipulate the state is by invoking a method.
I guess what I was wondering is, if you have two processes, two PCB, one is running something in kernel mode and when it's on user mode. When you do the contact switch, can you exchange some data between two blocks from user space to...
For the moment, I'm going to answer no, and I'm going to revise that when we get to talk about microkernels.
Okay.
But let's get contact switch defined first. Okay. So, according to the classic literature, a contact switch is the moment where you decide I'm going to stop running one process and you decide I'm going to start running another process. And you'll also see the term used to refer to this entire story of I entered the kernel, I selected a different process to run, and I exited the kernel. For reasons that are about to become apparent, probably Monday, this is not a good way to look at what's going on. Because it turns out there really are three different components in that context switch, and one of them sometimes doesn't really happen. So, why do we care about context switches? Usually we're concerned about the expense. There's a cost to enter the kernel. There's a cost to exit the kernel. There's a cost to switch from one process to another. In addition to all of those, there's a cost to whatever activity you ask the kernel to do for you. But we don't have a lot of control over that. We've got to do what you asked, or we've got to not do what you asked. As we, on Monday, talk about kernel threads, we're going to conclude that this is a very sloppy bit of terminology, because it is often the case. Why is it expensive to switch from one process to another? Well, the answer is it's not. There's a global pointer. In many kernels, that global pointer is called current. It's a pointer to the active process control block, and all it takes to switch processes is to whack that pointer. This is not an overwhelmingly expensive operation. So where does the expense come from? The expense comes from the fact that when you whack the current pointer, you also have to whack the address space. Because the mappings of my process are different from the mappings of your process. So in addition to whacking the current pointer, I have to whack the hardware address space register. When I whack the hardware address space register, I have to flush the translation look-aside buffer. Flushing the translation look-aside buffer is expensive at two levels. One, it takes time to do it. And the second is, having done it, I've just lost the content of the most important cache in the system. And immediately thereafter, I'm going to do a load restore instruction, and I'm not going to be able to translate it because the TLB entry is gone, and I'm going to have to go walk those page tables, and that's a lot of cycles on a modern machine. Because on most modern machines, the page tables are not cache. This is a main memory reference. That's not universally true.
Is there any benefit to saving the TLB state?
You can't. Yeah, well, actually you could, and there are systems that do, because there are systems that use software loaded TLBs, but that's a discussion that we probably ought to have in advanced architecture. In fact, there's strong evidence that the soft loaded TLBs may be a better design, but it's touch and go. It depends heavily on the cleverness of your programmers. So the real cost of the process switch, it's certainly not whacking the current pointer, it's losing the TLB state and rebuilding the TLB state. Now here's why I'm laboring over this, is it turns out that you don't always have to whack the TLB. Why would I not have to whack the TLB? Suppose I have two processes that have identically the same address space. Their mappings at all points are identical and have the same permissions. Well, what it means for those processes to have identical address spaces is they're going to share the hardware mapping structures. And if they share the hardware mapping structures, why should I whack the TLB only to reload the content that's already there? And I will tell the story about how you actually make this arrangement Monday. But the upshot of this is that the single biggest cost in the context switch actually sometimes does not happen. There's another sizable cost that I've so far neglected, which is, well, how do I choose which bean to run? I have 1,500 processes, I gotta pick one. And there's a policy decision involved in that. People would like to believe that policy decision is expensive. Yes. It is possible to implement a kernel stupidly enough that that policy decision is expensive. For the rest of us, it takes two pointers long. So, the story that a context switch is expensive, the most of that, there are three major costs. The entry, which on the Pentium in particular is horrible, like 500 cycles horrible. The context switch, which is even worse, if you actually have to whack the TLB, it's going to cost you 1,000 cycles and up by the time you're done. Unless you're really, really careful. And then getting back out to user mode, which is at least less expensive than entering the kernel on the Pentium, but it's still too damn expensive.
For reference, how many cycles do you usually spend in user mode between context switches?
Good question. I don't think anybody knows. There are older numbers that say that people, that if you look at overall behavior of systems, about 50% of the cycles are spent in the kernel. There are new numbers that call that into question. Now here's a curious observation. If half of your cycles are spent in the kernel, that means that for half of the time that you spend in your machine, the spec benchmarks are bloody irrelevant. Kernels don't look like spec benchmarks. We've been tuning our processors to metrics where we're probably already overfit. We have then ignored the other half of the execution of our processors because it's staggeringly difficult to measure. Okay, so be suspicious about the context switch thing, and good.
So I thought over here you said that, going into user kernel mode is just a jump.
Well, it's not just a jump. So on a RISC machine, it's very nearly a jump. It's a jump, it's a supervisor mode bit flip, and that has a couple of cycles away because of some hardware issues. And I gotta make a copy of the stack pointer, and I probably have to reload the stack pointer. Actually, technically, I don't have to reload the stack pointer, but I do have to make a copy if you're old. That's actually how it's approximately how it's implemented on the MIPS machine. On the Pentium, it's a long algorithm whose precise description occupies 11 pages. And by the way, it has several bugs in the specification. So the Pentium actually has a lot of modes and a lot of legacy behavior that it's carrying around, all of which collides in the implementation of that operation, which is why it's bad. It's why there are at least two ways to do it. In fact, three ways to do it on the Pentium.
Okay.
Good. So I started with round robin, and I talked about, I at least mentioned, priority scheduling. The static priority is really simple. The higher the priority, that's the one that wins. The highest priority wins. One thing you've got to watch out for, anytime you see someone talking about a static priority, you must remember that there are two different ways to express what it means to be a higher number. One is zero is highest, and the other is zero is lowest. Different systems use different strategies. Pay attention. On all static priority systems, you will discover that there's a fixed range. Maybe 0 to 16, it may be 0 to 256. It's not an arbitrary number. Over a whole set of topics in scheduling which are similar to the kind of topic about replacement policy. If I had an oracle, what program would I run next? So imagine, I also talked about the notion of preemption, right? Having to do with what happens when your quanta expires.
Expiration.
So that's the case where you enter the system because we've decided we're going to switch to something else. Now, if I had a crystal ball and if I didn't care about interactive response time, there are a bunch of orders I could run my processes. If I said, I'm going to start the process, I'm going to run it to completion. Well, I can do it sort of in whatever order they arrive. This is known as first come, first serve. And without regard to how long they are. And so I could have a case where my processes come in and I'm going to run them in the order of arrival. And so I'll get my first one, I'll have 10 units of time that it'll run, and my second one will have 4, and my third one will have 6, and maybe my last one will have 3. Also known as FIFO, for first in, first out. What's the average waiting time? Well, the first process doesn't wait at all. The second process is going to wait 10. Because it's going to wait for the first process to finish, where this is not a preemptive store. Right, so you can basically add up the numbers and do the division to work out what the average waiting time is. And the conclusion is, boy, if you get unlucky and you get yourself parked behind a long-running process, boy, you're going to twiddle your thumbs a lot. I'll tell you a story about that. A fellow I know, I've met, and I've had a number of conversations with, but I wouldn't say I know him well. He's a local restaurateur. He was one of the two partners who opened the Lamplighter up in Owings Mills, recently opened Christopher Daniel up in Timonium. Nice guy, really smart guy. Wait a minute, it wasn't him, somebody else. Okay. Tells me the following story, also somebody who's done restaurant stuff. He's trying to teach his staff about how people perceive bad service. So he arranged in all his meeting for all of his waiters and busboys and support staff. Comes into the room on time with everybody there. Says, hang on a minute, there's one thing I got to do before we start. Walks out of the room. Times it. Returns to the room exactly 2 minutes later and says, how long was I out of the room? The answers range between 5 and 10 minutes. Okay? People don't wait gracefully. Not even in cultures where they think they do, by the way. So this is not a great strategy. In fact, none of these are great strategies if we're doing interactive. Now, what can I do to reduce it? Well, I could lower the average delay if I reordered the processes. So if I had a crystal ball, and I knew how long the processes were going to run, I could sort them according to how long they were going to run, with the shortest one coming first. And this would mean... Okay, so let me just check them off here as I go. First come, first serve, and now we're doing the shortest job first, right? So this would lead to what's called the shortest job first policy, okay? And so if I do the same mix that way, right? Three will come at the front, then I'll get four, and then I'll get six, and then I'll get 10, and you can see that the average delay is shrinking. It's going to get computed the same way as before, but notice in the first story, every average delay, other than the very first process, already had this 10 built into it, right? Because the second process waited for the first, there was 10. The third process waited for the second, which was 10 plus something, right? So if you bring the shorter guys to the front, you'll get a lower average weight. When we start talking about round robin, what we say is, look, those wait times aren't good enough. And so what we're going to do is we're going to say, yes, we'll let them run, but we'll set a bound on how long they run, and then we'll switch. I need to define a term that you'll never hear again. This number, this 10, is called the burst length. It's how long the process would run if left to its own devices. Ignoring homeworks, you can now forget this term. Because if you knew the burst length, you wouldn't be doing fancy scheduling now, would you? Right? The burst length is something you only know if you're God. Or you have access to an oracle of some kind. I'm not talking about the one you can buy in the stock market, unfortunately. Two criteria commonly used for evaluating a scheduler are average waiting time and average completion time. So the cost, the good news about preemption is you lower the average waiting time to get each process started. It's now a function of the total number of processes, and it has nothing to do with how long they're running. If you had 100 processes, right, you could be the poor unlucky shoe in position 100. But it doesn't matter how long 0 through 99 are going to run in total, it only matters how long the quanta is. Because you're going to get max out of 99 times the quanta before number 100 runs. But the question to that is, does that long job, right, which might be the one that's doing missile defense for the incoming nuclear missile, probably not the real system, is going to get delayed by all those other jobs that are going to get Cuisinarted into the mix. So long job run longer. In fact, a preemptive policy therefore tends to favor shorter jobs inadvertently. Because the second a new job comes in, it gets thrown into the Cuisinart, it gets assigned a slot, you know, in the visit that we're doing, all right, and then another job comes in. If I have a lot of short jobs, those short jobs are going to finish, and each time I run one of them, it's going to take the long job and delay it a little more. In practice, this seems to be acceptable because there are very few long jobs in the universe. Okay. Static priority picture is pretty simple, and the problem is it doesn't work really. If you have the misfortune to get an infinite loop running at top priority, it's over. You'll never get the machine back. Because the pure static story says, always run the highest priority job, and if the highest priority job is not going to voluntarily give up the CPU, even if you preempt it, it'll still be a candidate to run because it's not waiting. And if it's a candidate to run, if it's the highest priority job, then it follows that it's the highest priority candidate to run, in which case the policy says that's the one you're going to go back to running next. So typically what you do is you compromise. You say, oh, static isn't quite what I wanted. I will introduce some kind of an adaptive mechanism. What I'll do is, here's a time zero on my schedule. And I'm going to say, at time zero, what are all of my candidates to run? Because I could have more than one process at the same priority level. And if they're all at the current, if there's nobody at priority level 10, I'm going to fall down to priority level 9. So the highest occupied priority level, I'm going to grab that one. All of the ready processes at that priority are candidates. That's all the processes that I'm going to run in this epoch. Good, so I do that. Suppose there were three of them. Now comes the adaptive part. That poor idle thread is not getting any attention. Also, probably your compile session is not getting any attention. So, what I'm going to do to recover from that, I want priority, but I don't want pure priority. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, at the end of the epoch, I'm now going to apply the following rule. I'm going to go across all the processes in the system applying the following rule. If you ran during the most recent epoch, your adjustment goes back to zero. You may not have had an adjustment, but if you had one, we're going to take it away. If you did not run during the most recent epoch, we'll add one to your adjustment. So initially, if I had three processes at priority 9, one at 8, and one at 7, and I apply this rule, first epoch, I'm going to run all the 9s. Now I apply the adjustment rule. Okay, and now what I have, well, the 9s stay the same because they ran. The 8 gets bumped by 1 because of the adjustment rule, and now it's effectively a 9. The 7 gets bumped by 1, and now I decide what I'm going to do for the next step. And the rule is, I find the highest occupier priority, and I run all the folks in that priority. But we're going to reinterpret what we mean by priority. We're not going to introduce the notion of an effective priority. The effective priority is the static priority plus the dynamic priority. The dynamic priority is the adjustment. Alright, so we start our epoch, we say who are the candidates, we now have 4 processes at an effective priority of 9, we run those 4, and we run the end of epoch processing. Now we get 9, 9, 9, this guy goes back to 8 because his adjustment gets cancelled because he ran in this epoch, and the last guy gets bumped again. And now his adjustment is at 2, and so he is effectively at 9 for the next epoch. And you can see that we're going to get progressively lousy service as we get to the people at the low end of this priority spectrum, but at least they'll run a little bit. On Monday, I'll explain the hazard of this, and we'll start in on multi-thread. Thanks.